The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Shantideva's Guide to a Bodhisattva Way of Life. Those who wish to protect their practice should zealously guard the mind. The practice cannot be protected without guarding the unsteady mind. But if the elephant of the mind is completely restrained by the rope of mindfulness, then all perils vanish and complete well-being is obtained. All fears and immeasurable sufferings arise from the mind. So this morning I wanted to speak a little bit about mind, meditation, and drawing on from some writings from Anileo, who's a Theravadan monk and scholar, and whose language is scholarly, but sort of helps us to understand our mind and our practice and why it's so challenging. You know, we talk a lot about the habits of mind and patterns, and we are introduced to Zazen as a practice of bringing our attention, developing mindfulness on the breath in the beginning and for a long time, and noticing the wandering mind and letting go and returning. And that's all sort of, you know, an essential, fundamental part of the practice. But then we can really wonder in why it's so difficult. Like, what's the deal here? You know, we set our mind to other things, we accomplish them. So what is it about letting go of thoughts, attachments? Why is it so challenging? You know, almost every practitioner, I'm guessing, gets discouraged and frustrated at different points and think, you know, why is this taking so long? Why is this so difficult? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with the Dharma? Shouldn't be like this. And if we really understand the depth and breadth and complexity of the mind, we can both appreciate the Buddha's enlightenment and how profoundly he saw into the inner workings of this mind, both in terms of its workings and also in terms of its fundamental nature, because they're unified. And it can help us to both understand what it is we're actually doing in Zazen, what are we practicing, why it is challenging, what are the challenges that we're facing. And so this passage from Shantideva is from his chapter on guarding introspection. And he's really just saying that if we want to practice, we have to develop our attention, our awareness, our mindfulness. We really can't do practice without that. There is no greed, anger, delusion, pride, jealousy, apart from the mind. There's no mindfulness, awareness, concentration, letting go, joy, compassion, without the mind. And so when Shantideva talks about guarding the mind, practicing, calming the mind, focusing the mind, we also speak of this as mind training. In a sense, our mind has been trained throughout our whole lives to work in the ways that it does prior to our engaging in practice. And now in practice, now we're becoming aware, we're becoming more intentional, bringing some deliberateness to it, and beginning to sort of see into what has been going on all along. It's sort of like, you know, at the beginning of practice, suddenly we begin to open our eyes and we realize we're on the interstate, filled with traffic, we're going 80 miles an hour, and our hands are not on the steering wheel. And that's been going on our whole life. So we can think of meditation as however many moments of the day that we sit on the cushion and bring ourselves to Zazen. We can think of it as gathering the mind, collecting the mind, quieting the mind. We speak of it in all of those ways. And that's true and important. In true Dharma practice, Zazen is the doorway into the house of the Buddha, into your mind ground, into selfless compassion, into the heart of being. And so we practice this within our sitting and walking and eating and working and speaking and listening. And so we study the mind. We study what comes and goes. We study what persists. We study our perceptions. We study our reactivity. We study. And Leo says, the conditioned character of the perceptual process is a central aspect of the Buddha's analysis of experience. And so I warned you, it's a little academic. But what he is talking about is completely about you and your mind and every moment. The conditioned character of the perceptual process. So in each moment, our senses come into contact within their respective fields, visual, auditory, taste, touch, sound, thought. And there's a moment of perception. We see something, we hear something, we taste something, we touch something. And we base everything on that. Everything. Everything we do, everything we know, everything that happens, everything that is happening, our past, present, and future is all based on those moments. The world. It's not just our experience, but the world itself is based on that, on those moments. The Buddha said, what is the origin of the world? In dependence on your eye and your visual objects that you see, and your awareness, eye awareness. The meaning of three is contact. They come into contact with each other. And with that as a condition, feeling, you have a sensation, right? In seeing something, in hearing something, in tasting something, there's a sensation, sometimes referred to as a feeling. And with that as a condition, there's desire. You like this, you don't like this. You're neutral, you're indifferent. And with that as a condition, we begin to grasp. We want more of it. Or we don't want any of it at all. We grasp. And with that as addition, there's a sense of self. I want this. I don't want that. I don't care. And with the self as a condition, there's a sense of having come into this life, I'm alive. I was born, I'm alive, and with that as a condition, I'm getting older. My goodness. And with that as a condition, I'm going to die. Uh-oh. And with that as a condition, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, despair comes to be. The Buddha said, this is the world. So see where he's pointing. He recognizes that our senses come into contact with what we call the world. But where he's pointing is towards ourselves. And conditions here means when factors have to come together in order to allow something to happen. Like in order for me to see something, I have to have eyes, there has to be a visual object, and I have to have consciousness. Nagarjuna said, because that is so, seeing is empty. The object is empty. The eyes are empty. Nothing exists on its own. Seeing something that appears to be outside of myself and thinking that I'm just having an objective experience is what we call delusion. And so the body and mind, with its senses, comes into contact. We experience something. We name it. We put it into categories. All of our associations begin to come into that. And so Analeo says, these conceptual proliferations tend to give rise, going back, he says, when we've had a sensory experience, these in turn stimulate conceptual proliferation. And these proliferations tend to give rise to further concoctions of proliferations and cognitions, which lead from the originally perceived sense data to all kinds of associations concerning past, present, and future. So what is he saying? So in those, all of those ongoing moments where we come into contact with something, that the mind grabs onto that, it sees something, and it begins to proliferate, right? And that all of our history, our memories, our associations, everything we think, everything we believe, everything we know, in a sense, floods the image, in a sense. I mean, really, it's our mind that's being flooded. But our perception is that the image is being flooded with that, and so it's like we're putting on all these filters that are changing our actual experience of the object. And the Dharma describes this as a proliferation, which is a pretty appropriate word. Proliferate means to increase rapidly, to grow rapidly, to multiply, to become more numerous, to mushroom, to snowball, to escalate, to rocket, to run riot. Right? That's what the mind does. And so as we're going through this, really, you know, reflect on this in terms of your own experience. Do you see this happening? If not, look more closely. This is a universal experience. Like you're sitting here this morning and you feel a sensation in your leg and you think, oh, I wonder if that's pain. Is it coming? The period just started. It's going to get worse. And then the mind begins to proliferate, right? It takes that sensation and it floods it with all of our feelings and thoughts and experiences and concerns and fears about what we call pain. So it started with just a very simple, very direct sensation, and then the mind proliferates, runs riot. Shanti Davis described this as an untamed, mad elephant. And he said, such an elephant cannot inflict as much harm in this world as does the unleashed elephant of the mind. And that these proliferations have a cognitive aspect. So we're having thoughts, we're thinking something, right? We're forming mental images, but they also have an affective quality, right? The emotion is arising, fear, anger, concern, anxiety. Both are happening at the same time. And really, if we pay attention, every thought we have has some emotional quality, some affective quality. So this idea of a thought just being, you know, words that have meaning, communicating something, a sentence forms in our mind, and completely absent of the body is just not true. Bill Waldron said, foremost amongst our cognitive mistakes, our delusion, basically, in the Buddhist view, is a deep-seated tendency to identify with our bodies and our feelings and our thoughts. Each of us harbors an almost innate sense that we actually are one or more of the five aggregates. But since this sense of self-identity occurs at the deepest level of our consciousness, it's difficult to discern, much less free ourselves of. That's why we chant the Heart Sutra every day, Avalokiteshvara doing deep Prajnaparamita, clearly saw emptiness of the five conditions, the aggregates, form, sensation, conception, discrimination, awareness, which is Buddhism's way of describing you, your person, yourself, your body, your mind, the whole of you. And by the Buddha's teaching, the world. And so Avalokiteshvara, deep wisdom came out of recognizing that there is no self in any of those aggregates. But the delusion is constantly putting a sense of self, identifying with forms, objects, sensations, feelings, perceptions, and so on. The Buddha likened it to, in terms of how deep it is and how difficult it is to free ourselves, to a soiled cloth that's really, really dirty. So you wash it, right? And it's washed clean, right? You've let go. You've realized that the aggregates are empty of self, that the self is empty of the aggregates, that you're liberated. But the cloth carries the scent of the soap. There's something that lingers, right? So even when it seems to be washed clean, there's still a residual scent that continues to waft through. So Shanti Anileo said, "The last stage of this perceptual process is an event of which one is the passive experiencer." So an essential part of what we're trying to see into, and as Bill said, it's difficult to see, it's difficult to discern that this is actually even happening. Because I just see something and I have an immediate reaction. I don't see that there's actual process in my mind that is taking place because it's become so habitual, which means, in a sense, condensed in an instant. And I'm not looking inward, I'm looking outward. I'm not looking at myself, I'm looking at the object. And my mind is, I don't have any concentration or mindfulness, so my mind is not actually found yet its inherent stability and spaciousness so that I can actually see what's happening. And so then it makes complete sense that we sit down, right? We take our seat and we don't look up and look at everybody else, right? The objects of the world to try and figure out what's going on here. We look inward and begin to study the mind. And so Anileo said, "The last stage of this process is an event of which one, you and me, is having a passive experience. Once the conditioned sequence of the perceptual process has reached the stage of conceptual proliferation," right? So we've seen something and now the mind is proliferating, "we become, as it were, a victim of our own associations and thoughts. The thought process proliferates, weaving a net built from thoughts, projections, associations, of which the thinker, you, me, has become almost a helpless prey at the mercy of this proliferating mind." And so passive here is in the sense that we're not intentionally trying to make this thing happen. We're not saying, okay, I'm going to look at this and then I'm going to sort of impregnate it with all of my history, my karma, my ideas, right? And then I'm going to escalate a cascade of thoughts and those are going to lead to all kinds of emotions and I'm going to entangle myself. No. I mean, that's the nature of the habit. We don't have to do any of that. In fact, if we don't do anything, that just keeps happening. If we don't practice that difficult to discern process that we are, in a sense, passive to, almost, will keep happening. The way in which we're not passive is that we're actively involved in it happening. And that as it's happening, which is the result of our past karma, in a sense, the mind that we've established up to this point, is in another way also not passive because that's also strengthening the tendency for that to happen in the future. So in a sense, when we don't practice, that cycle doesn't become interrupted, and so we're kind of ensuring that it's just going to keep happening. And in that way, that whole process seems to be driving itself. I mean, think about when you've been sitting and you really want to like free yourself of this particular entanglement. You really want to let go of this particular attachment. You really do. Like you're not kidding. And you can't. Almost. In the sense that in that moment, when you do actually bring mindfulness to it, you are practicing not grasping at it. Remember that those stages of the process. You see it. You used to be enamored of it, cherished it. You still do a little bit. But you really want to let it go. Because you realize, oh, this just, it's hard, it sucks, it's hurting. It's making my life harder. It's making everybody else's life harder. You really want to let it go. And so you're not grasping in the same way. You don't actually actively want this to happen. But we've built up already a kind of reservoir of process so that even as we're practicing not engaging, it still has strength. And so it seems as though we're a victim of this mind. It seems like we're helpless, but we're not. Because even that moment that we're practicing, we're not helpless. You're not helpless at all. You're very skillfully and in a very powerful way interrupting that cycle with your mindfulness. The reason we don't experience it that way is because we would consider it having those good qualities if the thing that we're bound in suddenly disappeared. Then we think, oh, it worked. Because it's an all or nothing kind of thing. If it's still there, it's not working. If it disappears, then it is. And that's the mentality in all of its many forms that we're trying to free ourselves of, that kind of dualistic way of thinking. So we're not helpless at all, ever, though it can seem like it in certain moments. And when he says almost helpless, that's the key. Almost. And so we practice those established habits and patterns grounded in mindfulness, daily practice, on and off the cushion. You know, we can't rely on however much we sit every day to develop our attention and mindfulness sufficiently so that we untie this knot. Because we're also sort of creating a false division between practicing in the way that we recognize on the cushion and then everything else. Another sort of view that we have to free ourselves of. So we have to practice throughout the day. And Zen is very good at that, right? When we're training together, that's exactly, I mean, Zen tradition is very powerful at that because it in a sense, ritualizes. It makes very conscious. Right, we don't just meditate and say, okay, now go off and just be mindful for the rest of the day. We practice walking and we hold our body in a posture of mindful walking. We do services, we do prostrations, and we chant, lowering our eyes. We do it as a meditation. We do it unifying the whole body, and we bring it into our meal. We bring it into our working. So it's very explicit what we're trying to do, what we are doing. And Leo goes on to say, the crucial stage in all of this is where the subjective bias can set in and distort the perceptual process. And this occurs with the initial appraisal of feeling and cognition. Initial distortions of the sense data arising at this stage will receive further reinforcement by thinking and by the conceptual proliferation. And so, you know, reading this style of a teaching can be difficult because it seems kind of dry, right? And that can be in a teaching like this, but it can also be in a sutra. And so what's important to keep remembering when we're encountering, because you don't want to just study stuff that is immediately, you get it, right? And it feels very warm and, you know, good. I mean, that's fine. But we're going to leave out a whole lot of very important teachings if we're relying on feeling. Like if I'm not feeling something when I'm studying this, then I don't want to study. I got to feel something. That's not good, right? We're limiting ourselves too much and we're relying too much on feeling. That's what this is saying. We're having a feeling and we're just judging it in a certain way. Because I'm feeling like, oh, this is dry, that means there's nothing here for me. I need to feel something right now. And so if what I would often do in years and years when I would be studying something, that I would have a feeling of dry and sort of like, I don't get this, and why does this sound so dense? And a lot of times what would hold me and keep me coming back was the importance of that particular teaching within the august history and tradition of the Buddha Dharma. In other words, I would reflect on all of the enlightened beings before me who thought this is a really important teaching, and I am going to decide it's not, right, in all of my depth of wisdom and understanding. And so that would like humble me, and it's like, okay, all of these other who were much wiser than me said, this is a really important teaching. You should study this. And so I would come back to it and keep coming back to it. And I would just keep remembering, they're talking about me. They're talking about my mind. They're talking about my practice. I'm just not getting the connection yet. And that's my job. My job is to keep working at it until I start seeing that connection, right? So, because then it becomes alive. And I can't expect that that's just going to happen in a moment, right? Because what's being addressed is something that is so deep and so profound, I shouldn't expect that I should just understand it all at once. So Analeo is saying that the subjective bias that we bring to our perceptual process. Remember when Jimon was studying to be a chaplain, she told me that the group that she was studying with, one of the chaplains said, when you're standing outside of a patient's door and you just read their, you know, their sort of medical, their stats, their age, their race, their gender, their illness, and the trainer said, do you like that person or not? And somebody said, I haven't even met them that yet. And they said, yes, you have. And the trainer was a Buddhist. You've already met them, because all of those identifiers, right, you've already learned to feel a certain way about those particular aspects. And so already going in, the bias can be, I don't like this person. This is going to be hard. They're going to be difficult. Or I like them. I like them already. I know this is, I'm going to really connect with this person. That's not the person. And so he's saying that subjective bias can already set in, we should assume it has, and distort what we actually experience, because we go in already knowing. And our cognition, not just what we feel, but what we think. And these distortions arise and reinforce, further reinforce by our thinking and by our emotions, by our affect, the object itself. So in a sense, what we already know, what we already believe, we then impute into the thing that we're experiencing, which just reinforces, yep, I was right. This person's going to be difficult. I knew it. You know, when I was waiting tables forever in my earlier years, that was something that as waiters and waitresses, we sort of, the people I worked with, very small sampling, but we often like thought we were good at. You know, we'd look at a table and like, oh, these people are going to be easy. They're going to leave me a big tip. You know, they're going to be difficult. They're going to stiff me. And I did that all the time. And I was already practicing, but it didn't come into that moment, right? I was bringing bias in. I didn't even realize it. But what I saw over and over again is very often the person would not reinforce my bias. They would surprise me. The people that I thought were going to be difficult would do something really wonderful, charming, loving, kind, generous. And the people that I thought were going to be really great sometimes weren't. And they just kept showing me my bias. And then he says, once the stage of this of conceptual proliferation is reached, then the course is set. The proliferations are projected back onto the sense data, the object, and the mind continues proliferating by interpreting experience in line with the original bias cognition. This is why the unexamined, untrained mind is a biased mind. And its bias is towards ourself. It's very ancient, that bias. It's primordial. It's genetic. It's survival. Is this a threat? Is this an enemy or is this an ally? Do I run towards this or do I run away from this? Is this good for me or is this bad for me? It's very, very old. And it's kind of necessary, right? But the thing itself, like the basic intelligence of that, gets overlaid, flooded, inundated with all of our conceptual proliferations, our bias, which is based on a lot of meaning and ideas, things that we've been taught, things that we've been told, things that we haven't examined. So the self affirms the self over and over again. The self reinforces the self over and over again. And not just the self, or rather the self which includes all of this, the whole world. And the Buddha makes very clear, what is that world? It's my every sensory experience, and it's everything that I've ever thought, believed, known, remembered, anticipated. And so think about Zazen. You sit and you turn your attention to the breath. What could be simpler? Because one, we're already bringing a bias in. We've already brought in ideas about Zazen, about meditation, about Buddhist practice, about enlightenment. Every once in a while, I meet somebody who's just arrived and they say, I have no expectations. And I'm just like, okay, right? Not possible. Even if you don't know anything about Buddhism, let's say you've never read a book, you've never heard a single word. Well, you've come into a monastery, right? Unless you're just asking for directions, I guess. But even then, you would have bias. You would have some sense of where you were entering, of this place, right? So we have those biases already, and so we bring them in. But then things get more lively, right? Because things start arising. Karma, things that we've experienced, our emotions, things that we're involved in right now, things that we're anticipating about the future, things that happened yesterday, things that happened 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, things that happened in a past lifetime, if you have trust in that. And we do exactly what this is talking about. We see, we project, we impregnate, we proliferate, we believe. We don't see that there is a process. We just see, oh, that thing is doing this to me, is making me feel upset, angry, joyful, lustful. We don't see that the world that I'm experiencing that moment is my mind. And there is something in front of me. And so think about, and so in Zazen, to have that moment of experience and to just see, just experience, right? So what's the basic teaching? Don't deny it. Don't suppress it. Don't avoid it. Don't try and get away from it. That's a form of grasping. This is bad. I am not this. It's identity. But at the same time, don't want more of it. Don't exaggerate it. Don't try and hold on to it and preserve it. Another form of grasping. And what happens when you don't, there's no aversion and there's no grasping at pleasure, is there's just the thing itself, right? And that bias and the proliferation is calming. So that's why it's so important to appreciate that when we're letting go, seeing what arises and letting go, it's not just a mechanical thing. You're not a machine. It's alive, and it's alive with all of the depth and complexity of what the Buddha is talking about, what these teachings are pointing at. That's why it's so difficult. And so think about our beyond fear work, right? So when we take that self, we take that bias towards ourself, which at the same time, a bias towards ourself means automatically we have a bias towards everything else. Right? When you build a wall, you have established a world inside, but you, at the same time, you've established a world that is outside. They go together. And so the things that I perceive as enemies, right? The things that I perceive as friends, the things that I love, the things that I love go along with the things that I don't love. The things that I am, by necessity, go along with the things that I am not. The things that you are, in my biased subjective mind, go along in my mind with the things that you are not. Right? So when we take that biased mind and we just look through the lens of historically constructed race, gender, sexual orientation, faith, age, pick your category, and that those categories have been filled with meaning over the centuries, and we have grown up in a culture in which we have learned consciously or otherwise, largely unconsciously from particularly people in dominant identities, because we didn't have to be aware of it, those things are acting, right? Those things are alive because we have learned that bias. And in that, if we can really appreciate that, we can understand why all of the different aspects of our bias towards the self, towards others, based on just generic delusion, based on race, gender, sexual orientation, and so on, why just studying as a sort of as an academic subject, studying the history, knowing where it comes from, knowing how it was created, understanding identities, important, is not enough. Because it's not just cognitive. It's emotional. It's affective. It's in the body. And that in the moment when we encounter a person, right, with different qualities, certain qualities, right, that image is flooded with our bias. We don't see it. We don't see that there's a process. And that process is not just me. It's the result of lots of processes that have been going on. Other people, societies, cultures, images, that have been propagating, proliferating those biases. And that we all experience them. We experience them differently depending on the body that we're in and the characteristics, the categories that we assume. But that's why I think Buddhism is so exquisitely, perfectly sort of positioned to help us with this, because it helps us to truly understand why those roots are so deep, why it's so difficult, why we can't just say, okay, I'm not going to be deluded anymore. I'm not going to do that thing anymore. I'm not going to see a person of color or a person of faith or a person of size or a person of anything. I'm going to see them just as they are because I've decided to do that because that's the way I want to be. That's a good intention, but it's not enough. We actually have to, in a sense, undo, free ourselves, interrupt, break the cycle of the whole process, that elephant of the mind that is untamed, that is unexamined. And ultimately, to go beyond just calming and realize that the whole construction, to use an old image, is like building a house in empty space. One of the images of you're in the water, in the ocean, and you paint a face on the water, right? It's there for an instant, but then it disappears, right? Because it's empty. There's no inherent intrinsic quality, no identity that exists in and of itself, in a person, in any characteristic of a person, in the thought that I have about the person, in what I've been told about that person, in the emotions I might feel about that person. None of them exist with any autonomy. They only exist, they become my world when I make them my world. And I do that in my mind in this process. And so if I want to free myself of that, I have to look very deeply into that, recognize it, Tibetan master Longchenpa said, the mind itself is a vast expanse, the realm of unchanging space. Its indeterminate display is the expanse of the magical expression of its responsiveness. Everything is the adornment of this basic space of emptiness, and nothing else. Outwardly, inwardly, things proliferate and resolve as a dynamic energy of the awakened mind. And because this is nothing whatsoever, it's empty, yet arises as anything at all. Here's a whole bunch of anything at alls. It is a marvelous and magical expression, amazing and superb. So here Longchenpa is speaking from the sort of the enlightened view, right? Because marvelous and magical from within suffering, it doesn't seem marvelous at all. Suffering is a terrible thing. What we inflict on ourselves and others can be terrible in the greatest degree possible. It doesn't seem marvelous and magical at all. Yet when we begin to see into the depth of our mind, which means we're seeing into the depth of other people's minds, because there's just one mind, then we begin to see what Longchenpa is talking about. You know, one way I think of this is, you know, talking to so many people who early in our lives, we all create strategies for how to like make this thing work. And so if you grow up in a house that's chaotic or violent or numb or angry or loving, but particularly in homes that are difficult and in our key relationships that are difficult, we have to figure out a way, because we're an animal, right? And every animal has to learn to adapt to its environment and survive. And so we create all kinds of strategies that are kind of brilliant. So we can deal with it by living in a fantasy world, right? Because this world, So we create a fantasy world. And that might be one in our own mind, or maybe it's through reading. We survive our life, our growing up by reading. Or we actually find different ways of just going to sleep, numbing ourselves, disassociating, distancing, so we don't feel, right? I know people who feel like they only survived their childhood through sports, because they were able to take the rage that they felt and channel it through a kind of controlled warfare, right? In which there were rules, right, and moral teachings, and you know, you couldn't just be violent and survive that way. But then the thing is, when we leave home, we don't leave those strategies behind, because the world we've lived in is the world we go to, because the world is this. And so even when it's no longer needed, it's still fully operational, fully functional. And I don't know that. I don't see it as something that I am doing. I don't see it as something that I could not do, other than just the will that I might try and marshal, that I'm not going to do this. And then I fail, and I fail, and I fail, and I fail. And there's a very important teaching, which I can't go into much, but that the Buddha recognized that we have underlying dispositions, latent tendencies. And these are these very strong tendencies, habit patterns, that each of us have that are universal but also particular to each of us. And that are very, and the term for that actually means to lie along with. They're like just laying there, just right on the surface. And they're ready to go. They're packed. Like, they have everything they need. They never sleep. They're ready to go. And all they need is just a little encouragement, right? And so something happens, and boom, there it is, right? It's activated, right? Just needs a little bit of a trigger, and boom, there it is. And you haven't decided for that to happen. You didn't want for that to happen. You didn't know that was going to happen. Boom. It's latent tendencies. And the Buddha said that one shall here and now, that we shall here and now make an end of suffering without liberating these underlying tendencies to desire, for example, for pleasant feelings without feeling the underlying tendency to aversion towards painful feeling, without illuminating the underlying tendency to delusion with regards to neutral feeling, he says, this is impossible. That's a pretty strong statement from the Buddha. Right? When the Buddha says something is, if you try and do this without doing this, it is not possible. He's not saying, well, you know, it's going to be hard, but take a shot. He's saying, you can't do it. Because that's the nature of our mind. And so he's saying, without freeing ourselves of these underlying tendencies towards grasping if it's pleasurable, towards aversion if it's painful, and towards delusion, confusion, if we're indifferent, we're not going to free ourselves. And so in this, when I think about this and reflect on this, which I do a lot, the only logical response, the necessary response, and I do bring a bias here, is Zazen. How else could we see into the depth of this, which is so difficult to discern, much less pull up by the roots, without a very sort of carefully developed path, method, such as Zazen is. But that the Zazen then needs to be, in a sense, embedded in a whole path. So I can't just rely on my Zazen, right? Because I got a whole bunch of stuff to do once I get off the cushion. And I'm bringing this along with, right? Which means I'm bringing that subjective bias, I'm bringing these underlying dispositions, I'm bringing in my kleshas, so I have to have more than just my Zazen, and more than just trying to bring my Zazen into my life. I need moral teachings that I study and that I make commitments to, right? I need different forms of practices, different ways of moving my mind and body. We call it art practice, body practice, work practice. I need to study with someone who knows more than I do, in the sense that they have had some insight into the depth of this and what actually works. Because although my mind is universal, I'm also kind of unique. Not unique in the sense of superior, but just unique in the sense of my constellation of everything. No one has gone through life exactly like me. Think about that. So in that way, you are utterly unique. So the Dharma has to be able to speak specifically and explicitly and directly to your person, your mind. But it can't require a different body of teachings for every single person. Couldn't happen, right? So it has to also be universal. And what I have found in really reflecting lives, it can really help us to not get discouraged, not get so discouraged, right? Because you realize it's not so personal, right? Everybody has this whole magical, wondrous mind. Everybody has grown up and have experienced pain and suffering. Everybody has incorporated their own particular strategies to live in this world. Everybody has their own particular attachments. Everybody shows up in the world in their own particular way. We call that identity. And so when we find ourselves struggling, rather than feeling like, why can't I do this? What's wrong with me? Just see that struggle as a sign of, oh, it is that deep. It is that strong. It is that powerful, right? But that mind that is so powerful is the same mind and the same power that frees us. It's the same mind. In a sense, we're using all of the same aspects, but now we're just using them skillfully. We're using them with wisdom, and we're developing the capacity to do that with compassion, which is sometimes difficult when it hurts. Shanti Deva said, tigers, lions, elephants, bears, snakes, all of your enemies, evil spirits and demons, they all become calmed by calming your mind, freeing your mind of these deep dispositions. Huainong said, alleviate all of the many beings in your mind. The Buddha said that all fears and immeasurable sufferings arise from the mind. And so the essential characteristic of guarding alertness, developing mindfulness, deepening that into concentration, is to examine again and again the state of your body, your speech, your mind, and to understand whether your actions are true in accord with the Dharma. Are they skillful? Are they beneficial? Are they in accord with the Dharma? Are they skillful? Are you practicing in a way that's skillful? And are you practicing in a way that's beneficial to you and to others? Shantideva said, if we want to put the Buddha's teachings, the Dharma, into practice, we should know that nothing can be accomplished just by reading words. A sick person will never be cured of their illness through merely reading medical instructions. That's why we're sitting in a hall of awakening, on the cushion, the diamond seat, in the posture of the Buddha. How fortunate we are.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.